This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. As a third grader, Phyllis Craig Taylor was part of the first wave of black students to integrate public schools in Alabama. It was a challenging experience. White students taunted her and threw projectiles. In fact, she gathered those items in a cigar box, and that box later served as evidence in a lawsuit to push for stronger integration of public schools. Phyllis Craig Taylor is now the Dean of Law at North Carolina Central University. And last year, former President Barack Obama picked her as an advisor for historically black colleges and universities. Her work through that advisory board has helped ensure that new education policies don't disproportionately hurt African-American students. Phyllis Craig Taylor joins me now on The State of Things. Welcome, Phyllis. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Dean of Law at North Carolina Central, but I want to take you back to growing up on that farm in Yantley, Choctaw County, Alabama. Tell us about growing up there.
You know what? It was a wonderful experience growing up on the farm. That was my little piece of heaven, in fact. I'm the baby of 12 children, born to Thelma, Onita, Roberts Craig, and Richard Clifton Craig. You know, they are special people, Frank. My mother was 16 and my father was 22 when they married, and then they would go on to have six girls and six boys that they would raise there in Yantley, Alabama.
And your dad did, both your mom and your father, I want to talk about each of them, but your father started out a sharecropper and ended up with 60 acres. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, when my father asked my mother to marry him, she explained that property was really important and property ownership was important to independence. And so as a sharecropper, he actually approached the landowner that he worked for and negotiated the initial purchase of 2 acres, which is where our home site is now. And if you go to Yantley on Route 32, you'll still find our house there. They go on to purchase adjoining land and accumulate 60 acres there. Now, that didn't happen in a short period of time, but over the years, they were able to put enough land together to run a small farm there.
That's not easy to do because, as you say, land ownership and wealth building is the road to independence, and certainly the white folks who ran Choctaw County, Alabama, understood that, and that made it difficult, didn't it, to accumulate that kind of land?
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that I grew to understand with all of my education that was afforded me, that they were two extremely brilliant people. They were great business people, and they understood psychology. So my father had a unique way of putting people at ease and appearing not to be a threat, even though just the sheer desire to accumulate that type of land during Jim Crow in South Alabama had to be threatening to some people. But that was just his way. He was a charmer. He was a person who was quick with a joke, and he usually accomplished his goal. But he was smart in the ways that we now call emotional intelligence. Mm-hmm. Even though he only had a third grade education, he was smart in so many other ways that he would go on to, I think, do a very good job with what they started with, which was nothing.
Started with nothing, then you negotiate 2 acres, you turn that into 60 acres, you've got 12 kids you're going to raise. And you've said that your father's kind of an introvert, but your mother, this freed her up a little bit, gave her the independence to do her outside work, much more extroverted.
Yes, and you know, probably people would question whether or not my father was an introvert or whether or not he understood situational psychology. So at home, I would say that he was very boisterous.
I see.
And he was a jokester.
12 kids.
That's right.
12 kids.
He had to manage, a lot. And there's a story about that too, Frank, if we get to it later in the interview. But now my mother actually had a ninth grade education. And she returned to high school and actually rode the bus after she had had 7 kids. All of them were getting on the bus, and she got on the bus with them. And she actually graduated high school. Wow. So she had a bit more education and was able to read all the paperwork that they needed, and she was masterful with numbers.
So she knew education was important. The Brown versus the Board of Education was the law of the land, or at least a court decision that was about 10 years old or so by the time you're in third grade. She understood the importance of education. Talk about the decision to send you to the white school, and sort of what the law of the land was, because in the South, there was not going to be a rapid transition to integration.
No, it wasn't. Even though the Brown case had said with all deliberate speed, in Choctaw County, all deliberate speed turned out to mean as slow as possible. And so there just wasn't much progress there. So initially what they did was put in place a freedom of choice plan. And that's where families could opt to attend what had been historically the other race's majority school. Well, no white parents opted for their children to attend the historically black elementary or high school. And only a few of us in the end ended up attending the white school because there was massive community organization to say this is not integration if we're only taking our children into what had been the white schools. So many of the parents pulled out, and I think there were about 140 families initially who were willing, but they were all African American. There were no white families willing. So off we went. My mother was firm that some children were going to have to go. So my sister Carol was going into high school, and my brother Quentin was 2 years ahead of me. And there I was off in third grade going to what had been the white elementary school.
And your mother had to know that you would face some antagonism and some hard times being in the vanguard of this integration effort. What did she think about that? Did she talk to you about what you would face and prepare you for it?
Yes. Well, she said that it was important. And she was a person who believed that you took actions and you lived your life not just for yourselves, but to improve community, society, and for the future. So she told me that I was going to make a difference in the lives of so many children who were going to have what she believed at that time was a higher quality of education. So one difference would be moving from where I had attended school, the segregated school. Whenever I received a textbook, there was a place in the front of the book where you'd write your name in the school year. All of those spaces were already taken by the time we would get those textbooks. Many times they were really outdated, right, and the information had been changed. We didn't have proper funding for facilities repair. So she thought that this was an equalizer, and she talked about that. Now, of course, I was a very young child at the time, so I don't think that I quite understood it until I was there and was met with some of the sneers and the glass shards and rocks that were thrown.
Well, tell us more about that. What did you experience?
Yeah, well, it starts right away. So you show up, you know, on the first day, and no one says hello to you. And I can't remember, and this kind of is the telling part. It's not just the children, but I tried in preparation for this interview to remember the name of one teacher or one administrator, someone probably that had reached out to me so they would be memorable, and I couldn't remember one. So it wasn't just the children, but I will say that the adults were not throwing things, and they were not participating in some of the little side jokes and games that the children would play. But I think that it was quite jarring as a small child, because before this, I had lived in the bliss of my happy tribe, and then off to school to people who had taught my older brothers and sisters. So they were expecting me, kind of the last of the lot of the even dozen. So it was surprising. So when I went home, and I think I was, I'll say the word sad, but I think it probably was something more than sad. My mother came up with just a genius idea in parenting, and she found an old cigar box that was at the house. And she told me to take it to school and to try to fill it up every day with all the things that were being thrown at me, and that it would be evidence and that we would go to court. And she explained to me the court system and how you could use laws to change situations. And if people were being mistreated, that there was a judge who wanted to hear about that, and that that judge would then put a ruling in place so that this wouldn't happen to other children in the future. So she gave me a purpose for my day to deal with some of the negative things that were occurring. So I thought I was on this mission, helping the lawyers to build this case. And I'm looking at the kids as they're doing this and thinking, you don't know you're helping me, because I'm going to pick this up and this is going to be evidence.
Well, not only is there the genius of giving you a mission and making you look forward in some way to filling up that box, so turning the whole experience around for you, but also implicitly her faith in a system that would and could. There are judges. There is a right in this country. And even though we don't experience it here, there is a right in this country, and we can access that.
She thought that the adoption of Brown, that we had crossed over to a new plane. Now, she understood that it was not going to happen instantly and that there was going to have to be some resistance and a fight to win those rights. And she didn't mind being on the front, you know, of that. And she was. But at the same time, it was something inside of her religion and prayer that made her believe in the goodness of some people, that she thought they just needed to have this impetus and that this was it, that this was that moment. Frank, I can't say that by her death, she had that same viewpoint.
I'll tell you what, we'll take a break and we'll talk more about that when my conversation with Phyllis Craig Taylor continues, the Dean of Law at North Carolina Central University. Our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, and my guest today is Phyllis Craig Taylor. She is the Dean of Law at North Carolina Central University. But long before she started her career in law and education, she was playing a part in the civil rights movement in the United States of America. And we talked about, you know, being a third grader in the public elementary schools in Alabama. Now, so by the time you get into high school, what did things look like? Tell me about your high school experience.
Yeah, you know, it was better. Definitely better. No one was throwing anything at you and sneering, at least not the students. But what you confronted were still the adults who were in charge, who had not accepted fully that the schools needed to be desegregated. So it was a better experience, but still not the experience that most people would think of as the kind of good memory high school experience. I didn't graduate from high school. That's an example of how I viewed my high school
experience.
Well,
tell me about that, because you decided that you were ready to go to college a little bit earlier, and I think this will shed some light on what you mean by the white teachers and counselors not being quite ready for this.
Yes. Well, I wanted to get information about the college admissions test, so I went in to see the guidance counselor. And I asked her for information because I knew that there was a test coming up and I wanted to prepare for that and register for it. And she asked me for if I had the money to pay the fee to register. And of course I didn't. But I knew that my parents would come up with it, because they would. Whatever sacrifices they had to make, they had made them for everybody else, and they would do the same for me. But she wouldn't give me any information. She told me that I was not college material and that I needed to consider some options that would be more appropriate for my people. That was a real punch in the gut, because I had watched all of my other siblings go off to college. And I was looking forward to that moment, and she had taken something away that I was looking forward to. Well, my mother came down and she corrected that. So she was met with a very stern lecture about who my people really were. And I would go on, and I took the ACT and talked to administrators at Livingston University, which is now the University of West Alabama. My sister Carol had attended there. and she worked for the vice president for academic affairs. So I sat in his office and actually got a meeting to discuss coming to college early.
Well, I want to talk more about that, getting to college early and where that college career led. But I also want to stick with your mom for just a minute, because she, as you suggested, as you said, went down and sort of set your counselor straight about some of the challenges that you were facing. The counselor didn't think you'd have the money. There were all of these challenges, both financial and, of course, there were the infamous literacy tests that blocked mm-hmm. voting. That was the form of voting restriction back then. We have new forms now. But tell about that, because your mother was very active in seeing that African-Americans were registered to vote.
Oh, absolutely. My mother actually was the fourth African-American female who passed the literacy test and was registered to vote in Alabama. So she always stepped out on the forefront. After that, she realized that the literacy test was going to be a problem, so she organized citizenship classes where you taught the information from the Constitution and American history to adults so that they would be ready for the literacy test.
Because this is not a one-page placard that you have to get through.
Oh, no. It was a lengthy test, and what was interesting, it seemed to change, too, as you did the education over time. Mm-hmm. Then new questions would pop up on the test, and if people missed even one question, then they would be turned away. So she was very active in organizing people to register to vote and just for improving the community from an economic standpoint, too, and fighting for jobs. So she was active in the Choctaw County Civic League, and she organized people really all across southwest Alabama to get involved. And it was interesting because I don't know how she made this connection, but she actually received a stipend for a while as a community organizer with the American Friends Service Committee. And we had lots of Quakers that visited our home and got to know many of them. And they were very supportive of her. But it did put her in danger. And clearly, the rest of us were in danger. We had cross burnings in front of our home, and even on one occasion, someone shot into our home. So, but we weren't taught that meant that you stopped what you were doing. It just meant that it was more important for you to persist in what you were doing, and that someone had to take the risk if there was going to be real change. And she didn't ever show any fear. And I don't know how that is possible looking back on it. But I think that she felt she had to put a strong face on for all of us because we were being impacted by those actions.
Well, you were. And that's part of my next question, I think, or the jumping off point, because it's one thing for parents to have this aspiration for their children, quite another for their children to take it on, particularly if they've borne the brunt of some of this themselves. What was your reaction to this when you were in high school? Was it, would you please stop putting me in harm's way, Mom and Dad? Or did you feel, even at that age, that you really did have a responsibility to take this on, to take this fight on for yourself?
No, she was an inspiration. Mm-hmm. And I never remember thinking that I shouldn't do it. I fully understood, maybe because it started at such a young age, that this was part of my mission. I'd go on to be in high school the president of the Alabama Students for Civil Rights group. So I was becoming a leader in my own right because I wanted to follow in her footsteps.
This may go back to some of the genius in their parenting, and I don't know if it does, but you tell me the way you were assigned chores, because with 12 kids and 60 acres, I'm guessing you were working pretty hard. But the way that chores were assigned had an influence on your own self-esteem and confidence.
Oh, absolutely. You know, this is an interesting dynamic in our household. Because there was so much work to be done, everybody had to do the amount of work that they were able to do based upon your age and your strength. And you were taught techniques to use that you could actually do a lot more than you thought you could do. So my brothers cooked and the girls worked in the field along beside them. And there was just never that gender discrimination. Now, when it came to plowing before we had a tractor, of course, our brothers handled the plow. But those are like really few distinctions that I can think of where they said, okay, this is something that the boys are going to do and this is what the girls are going to do. But having to take responsibility, and once you were given that responsibility, you were not even reminded. You understood when you had to do it, what it was that you had to do, and that you are working as part of a team. And I tell people I learned so much more about management and leadership in that house than any other leadership or management program that I have attended, because it was a family goal. Everybody played a part. And then you carried out your responsibility. And yes, there were consequences if you did not.
So tell us about getting into school early, because initially the university or the college was not about to let you in early. You had to work a deal, right?
I did work a deal. So it was probably my first masterful negotiation. It may have been because he wanted me to leave his office because I was doing my own version of a small sit-in there.
This is the head of academic affairs?
Yes, yeah. The vice president of academic affairs, for which I had no appointment to see.
I see.
But I was just very amenable to waiting as long as I needed to wait. It wasn't a problem. And when I talked to him about the tensions in the high school and the role that my mother had played, and that I thought that was impacting how I was perceived in the high school, what he finally said, and I think this was just to get me out of his office, was that I could enroll in the summer, but I had to make all B's. And that if I made all B's, I could come back in the fall. Well, I hadn't had my 16th birthday. So I think he thought, this is a way to appease the child. She'll feel that she got her chance. And then in a year, I'll see her back when she has graduated from high school. Well, I made all B's and came back in the fall and hadn't looked back since.
And then where did you go? You went there for
a year.
For a year. Yeah.
Just one year. And then transferred to the University of Alabama on my college transcript from what was then Livingston University.
And what was your major there?
Well, it was business administration, but I got a teaching certificate while I was there because I was always interested in education, because land ownership, number one, was taught as a way of independence, but education was the way to have more opportunity. So they believed in education in our house.
When did you decide to take up law?
Well, you know, I think in the third grade, right? I was collecting evidence.
That's
so
right.
I think then. Right. But, you know, there was a telling moment during my mother's days as a community organizer where she was working with a group of sharecroppers, and they formed an organization called the Panola Land Buyers Association. And she worked with them to purchase land, work together. And there was a lawyer there, and his name is Hank Sanders. It's Henry Sanders, and we all call him Hank. And I sat on the floor, and he was trying to assist them in filing a complaint because they'd had retaliation based on some of their actions. And I say that right there, sitting on the floor and witnessing that, I understood the power of a lawyer. I watched grown men and their hands would shake when he'd ask them that he just needed one person to be the named party to sign a complaint, and that he was able to put them at ease and out of that group to find one. And I understood at that moment that the lawyer's role was more important or just as important as the judge. Mm. And so I would say that's probably the turning point moment. So I pay homage always. And I should say that Senator Sanders, he went on to become a senator in the state of Alabama, is a mentor and a friend to this day.
Well, so you did get a law degree from the University of Alabama. And you worked for a while in North Carolina, right? But you returned to Alabama.
Yes.
I want to talk about your clerking experience with the Alabama Supreme Court.
Yes. When I went back to Alabama, just a couple years out of law school, and I went to our career placement office there at the University of Alabama at the law school. And one of the positions that was listed as accepting applications was a clerkship for a newly elected judge, Justice Kennedy. And I applied and got an interview with him, and we had a very interesting interview, not like one that I've had since that time. And in the end, he offered me the position. And this is only a special moment because he was the son-in-law of George Wallace, married to Peggy Sue Wallace. And he was being invested as a new Supreme Court justice in Alabama and decided that of his two clerks, the other was a white male, one would be an African-American female who came off of a farm in Yantley, Alabama. And it was a message that, for me, was very, very important. And he said that it was for him also.
What was unique about that interview?
Well, that in most interviews you talk about your qualifications, and for most clerkships, it's like, you know, if you were top in the class and what your honors were, and of course you do a lot of research and writing. And we got through that part of the interview very quickly, and then we moved on to the conversation about the optics and how comfortable I felt with the optics. And he allowed me to ask him questions, and I wanted to know why he wanted to do this. Right. If I was going to be that number two person standing there, why was it important to him? And he said the right things, and I was...
What did he say?
Well, he said that he thought that the time had come for people who were in positions of high visibility to indicate that we needed some separation from the past and that there were some things that needed to die. And with his father-in-law and his stand on, you know, on segregation, or I should say for segregation, that was, to me, that meant that he was a very thoughtful person, that he had thought about that, and he was consciously making a choice to separate himself from that. And it didn't bother me that I would be the face of that, because now at this point, it's probably all I know is that person.
When you talk about optics politically, that can work in both directions. The optics of an African-American clerk at the Supreme Court in Alabama for a white population, but also the optics of perhaps appearing to be the token mm-hmm. choice. What was he talking about? When you talk about optics, what was that conversation?
Yeah, well, he had his own reason for doing it, which is he was separating himself out from his father-in-law's politics. For me, it was even more important because I needed that position to show that I could do that work, which meant that I was opening the door once again for other African Americans who could come in and do the work. So it may be strange optics at the beginning. It's like, well, okay, are you the token? Let me be the token, because I know I can do the work. And if I can do the work, then all of a sudden it turns it into something different, which is a pathway now that has been, I think, created for others who can follow.
You went on to teach. You focused on teaching law, taught at the University of Florida, University of Warsaw, North Carolina Central, and other schools. Tell us about teaching law and your joy and passion for that.
Well, you know, in the classroom, you get to do something that is just magic, which is you take people from being a layperson to an expert, and you see the light bulb come on. And instead of representing clients one by one and trying to impact lives individually yourselves, you create your own mini army that you put out every year who's going to go out with a different viewpoint. So when I taught, I always asked my students to look beyond just the words in the opinion, but think about, who are the parties? What's the time period here? What was the politics in the country? What are the other factors that may have led to this particular decision? And let's talk about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing to have happened. And so I think I enhanced their legal education just because of my own experiences, where I learned that rules that can look very objective and neutral on paper can turn out not to be neutral at all when you start to implement them. That if you realize that certain people are coming to the table with less, then all of a sudden a rule that is on its face a fair rule is not, because you have disadvantaged the people that you knew did not have all of the qualifications of other people or the experiences.
Or the advantages coming in. I think that's where property law, and I think it's something you focused on early, is so important. Tell us about your attention to property law.
Well, one of the things that I experienced growing up was watching people like my parents, who had given blood, sweat, and tears to accumulate tracts of land just so that they could have some economic independence, losing that land based upon how certain laws were being implemented. And that made me just firmly attached to property law and helping the students to see how this particular area of the law can either help people in wealth building, or you could actually turn these rules around and help to remove wealth and strip wealth out of communities. I mean, that would be one of the areas that I would also focus on for my scholarship and looking at heirs' property. So my father, although he did support me in going to law school, he did ask me, though, how many clients would, at that time, he said, a colored lawyer have. So he was a little bit concerned about how I was going to make a living. But he wouldn't have gone to a lawyer himself. He didn't trust lawyers. And he believed that the intestate succession laws would protect the property just through inheritance. Well, that's a terrible thing to have happen, especially when you have large families, because now you are fragmenting the ownership across a large number of people, which invites someone else coming in and possibly buying a share. And the way the law works, that person can then ask that the whole tract be put up for sale under certain conditions. And so I was watching people actually losing wealth and understanding how difficult it had been to obtain that land. That disturbed me.
And historically, that had been what was happening, particularly with African-American families from the end of the Civil War. Well, I'm going to talk more with you, Phyllis Craig Taylor, who is the dean of the law school at North Carolina Central University. We'll talk about your experience there and what do you think is going on today. She is also talk about the fact that former President Obama chose her to advise him on historically black colleges and universities, and find out more about that when our conversation continues. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with Phyllis Craig Taylor, who is the dean of the law school at North Carolina Central University, and experienced being part of the first wave of African-American students to integrate public schools in Alabama. We talked about coming from there to where she is today and teaching law, and then North Carolina Central. So tell us what brought you to North Carolina.
Well, you know what? I had the opportunity to meet the dean of the law school at North Carolina Central University, Janice Mills. And she actually had the exact same teaching package that I had at the University of Florida, which was property law and real estate finance. As she was going into the deanship, they were going to have to hire someone to come in and take over that teaching load. And she encouraged me to be one of those candidates. Well, eventually, I was successful. I would leave the law school, though, from teaching capacity and actually go on and do some administrative things, then return in 2012 as the dean after a rigorous search process.
Well, let me talk about that, where you were in between, because it's in the news right now. So I need to talk with you about the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, where you were Associate Dean of Academics. Department of Education recently cut that. It's a for-profit school, and it cut off access to federal student loans. It's been in the news under investigation for, you know, being a kind of a loan mill and not paying enough attention to students and perhaps not being in business. It's a for-profit school, and I just wonder what your impression of that school was at the time when you were associate dean.
Yeah, well, you know, when I joined that organization, they had a very different view, I think, than the one that where they are now. So if we go back to the beginning, what they were interested in was creating a different model for legal education. We've kind of been doing the same thing in legal education. You'll see changes in other types of educational programs. Medicine would be kind of at the top of that list. But we do the same case study method that was the Langdalian method that started at Harvard, and we are slow to change. So that was the initial idea, was to create a model that was more focused on the students and more focused on what you actually do when you're practicing law. I don't think that that particular organization ever intended to be in this long term. I mean, they were funded by private equity, and in their model, they flipped their product. They create quality, so they were going to create this new type of law school and create a high quality and a good brand, and then they'd be able to flip it. Well, something happened out there, and it was called this Great Recession that we went into. And applications to law school started to turn downward. The student debt loan crisis was making front page news, New York Times, and all across the country. And they were not going to be able to flip that particular law school. So I think that they had to change direction. So it's like getting on a ship and setting course for one destination and then seeing the ship not veering off course, but turning severely in a different direction. I left, and after that, it appears that there were changes in the curriculum and some other changes that took place. And I can't really speak to exactly what was going on internally at that point, since I was no longer there. But I can say that it has been troubling for all of us in legal education to think about the students that are being directly impacted by this, because they were stepping into what they, for many of them, thought was their pathway to a successful career. And now they are facing a school that may be doing teach out and closing. They're having difficulty getting financial aid. And my heart breaks for those kids.
Well, North Carolina Central University, where you are dean of law now, is, of course, a public university and regularly at the top of the charts for the best bargain, the best deal for your money in terms of law schools and its high quality. What is it about talk about the difference between being in a public university with that charge and, of course, all the political turmoil that can go around that because you're beholden to so many funders. On the other hand, you don't have you don't have shareholders who are looking for a quarterly profit. What's the environment there like at a public university, particularly one with the esteem of the law school at North Carolina Central?
Well, it's quite different than in a private school or definitely for-profit institution, because you have to be very sensitive to the state budget. And there can be budget cuts that come at any time. So you have to be very strategic about how you plan your programs and what resources you're going to actually allot for different activities. So I think that that's a major piece of it. But, you know, this school is founded on the mission of being what we call the gateway to opportunity. When Dr. Shepherd started the law school, it had at its core being the place that would allow African Americans to get a legal education. It would go on to open its doors first to Native Americans and women, and now being one of the most diverse law schools in the nation. So I think we find a lot of support in the way that we carry out that mission, and then doing that always with the focus on the quality of the program. And so I think that as long as that stays as the centerpiece, is the quality. What in fact is the educational value, your value add that you're doing every day? And then you can figure out the harder parts, which is kind of how to manage in different political climates when there may be more funding or less funding. I'll say something else that's unique. I think we hire people to work at the law school. I have an incredible team who are committed to that mission. And they didn't come because I pay and can offer exceptionally high salaries. They came because they are committed to the mission and what we're doing there.
Part of the mission is a lot of clinical work and a real commitment to social justice. Talk more about that and how it's organized, how it's structured.
Right. So we have 12 different clinics that we run at the law school. So we try to offer students the opportunity to do transactional work and litigation work, all the way to IP. So when you look at, we really run the gamut and the different experiences that students can get. So we want them ready when they go out and start representing clients. They're not doing their first client interview or their first counseling session. They're not even making their first opening in court. They've been to court and stood with a client, had to handle a case. those cases are handled, of course, by the students, but under the supervision of our clinical professors. Now, the people that we serve are primarily low-wealth individuals who would not be able to access this representation if they were just going into the marketplace because they couldn't afford it. We see that as part of our social justice mission, because that's how we give back to communities, and that's a wealth-based program. In addition to that, though, we have tons of other pro bono programs where the students go out and help community organizations in many different ways. And it's been impactful. I think you look at that and you make the next step to the graduates, that they leave there with a sense of commitment to giving back to their communities. And in almost every county in the state of North Carolina, you will find our graduates in leadership positions, where it's city council or mayor or county commissioners, or they're in the state legislature. And if you go into the courthouse, you're going to find them on the bench and either as the DA or the public defender.
Well, all that you described sounds good to most ears, but there are some ears who may have an ideological bent that don't like the social justice aspect of this. It's publicly funded, and the commitment to serving low-wealth people who then could become empowered. This can be a threat to certain power sources, and I wonder if that's a political challenge for you, especially now, these days, for North Carolina Central.
Well, I think realistically that you're right, that it can be. I would say that when people come to our law school, though, and they visit, and they have the opportunity to actually see what we do and how we transform lives there, usually they come away with one consistent statement, which is, I was surprised. So I put that now in my invitations when I invite people to the law school. And I said, well, just come and spend a little time with us and let us surprise you, because we can do that. When they look at economically what we're giving back to the community, I think that that makes a big difference. One of those clinics is a small business clinic, so it focuses on entrepreneurship. So we're helping people who want to stand on their own and to invest back in the community. They're not trying to take anything out. They're trying to give back to the community and do that at the same time while creating a firm economic base for themselves. That's kind of hard to argue with.
Tell us about being on President Obama's advisory board on HBCUs.
Well, I could say never thinking that in my lifetime that I would see an African-American elected president in this country. It meant more than words could ever express just to be asked. And then having one of our first issues to be how we could put regulations in place to make sure that we didn't have a student loan debt crisis in the country. And one recommendation was putting in minimal credit scores for students and for parents who wanted to get Parent PLUS loans. Well, that would have a direct impact on HBCUs. But just because of our student population kind of coming out of the foreclosure crisis, we saw those families take the hit, and we know their credit scores were lower. Being able to bring that as a dimension to the conversation, I think, was telling for so many of the people in the Department of Education who just hadn't thought about it that way. Again, a rule that seemed as though it would be objective on its face, but not putting any historical context around it, you could see that it would have a discriminatory impact on certain populations more than other populations.
And you came up with an alternative rule that still protects the credit worthiness of students and protects the integrity of the program. It's just not that.
Tell us about the alternative. Absolutely. So instead of just having a one-factor test where you were looking at credit score alone, but look at credit score and then look at that recent payment history. And if the person had 6 months or more of on-time payments, they could still qualify for that. So it showed that they were trying to recover their credit score. Of course, they hadn't been able to do it quite yet, but they were at that point being very responsible about how they were managing their debt and making their payments. And we didn't think that young people, students, should be punished because someone didn't have that credit score at that moment. I mean, I had law students in my program who had finished 2 years of law school and would not have been able to return for a third year because they wouldn't have been able to obtain the resources needed to pay their tuition and fees. And that just would have been a travesty. And I don't think that that is, in fact, what the policy was designed to accomplish.
No, and as you say, once you pointed it out, and a very strong alternative was immediately, or at least over some period of time, developed. Barack Obama is no longer president. Donald Trump is. And I wonder what you think about the environment these days. I mean, we have a president who recently asked a black reporter to set up a meeting with him with the Congressional Black Caucus. I don't know. What's your sense of what's going on today?
Well, I will say that some of the rhetoric and the anger that I have seen bubbling up in the country has harkened back to my early years, and it is heartbreaking to think that this is where we are as a country, that we are dividing people instead of bringing people together. I think that the Congressional Black Caucus will have to meet with the president. He was elected, and they will have to meet with him, and hopefully over time maybe they can impact his views. That is always the place where we start, with great hope. I think the more difficult part is some of the messaging that I think we're sending to people across the country, that it's okay once again to be divided, and that it's not a good thing to work together, and that there should be haves and have-nots. And what we're doing is convincing people that they need to fight over crumbs or one small slice of the pie. And it's almost like the large, bright red flashing light off in the corner. And we're saying, don't look at that light, because what they need to look at is where 99% of the pie is. And it's like, okay, where is that wealth? And what are you fighting over? You're focusing on the wrong people.
Right. If we want to take a look at the credit scores of the people who are crashed in 2008 and the banks are still going and Donald Trump can go bankrupt four times and still come back. Yeah, it does make you wonder where we're focusing our attention. But I think back to your mother's confidence in our system. We were coming out of a system of Jim Crow and systematic violence against African-Americans in the South. She saw a ray of hope with Brown and was willing to work. Now we have a white supremacist and a white nationalist at the ear of the President of the United States, who is harping on the same insecurities and pandering to the same fears that George Wallace did. And finally, George Wallace renounced. He came to a point where he realized how evil what he was doing was. And now we have a president who's doing the very same thing. I just wonder, you know, what your, in terms of optimism, your mother's optimism and your optimism at this moment.
Well, I think we have to stay the course. To say that I'm heartbroken doesn't mean that I've given up. I am discouraged by where we are, but I understand that we have to fight. And that many times when you see progress, you will see that type of retrenchment where people will say, okay, no, this is too much. And I think that's where we are in the country now. So I think that we are in danger of seeing some rights loss, of seeing cases that have given rights and equality reversed. Policies and practices.
I've only left you 30 seconds for this one, but we are seeing coalitions of resistance build. Are you optimistic that they are, you know, maybe a way forward?
Yes. If the organizing is done properly, I think that we can show up and we can sing and we can rally. That's a good thing, but it takes a lot more than that. And I would say my mother understood that as a community organizer, that it takes a strategy and a plan that is going to take time to execute.
I want to thank you so much, and I wish we had more time. Phyllis Craig Taylor, the Dean of Law at North Carolina Central University, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it.
We've got more information at our website, stateofthings.org. And by the way, the next episode of Movies on the Radio, we want to hear about your favorite Westerns. They have changed a lot over time. You may want one of the classic Westerns or one of the more modern. In any case, send us an email at sot@wunc.org to tell us about your favorite Western, and that will be part of Movies on the Radio the next time that show is up. On the State of Things, produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wadarski sitting in today. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.